This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents The Last Tribe, written by Brad Manuel, performed by Scott Brick. Book 1. 1.
I don't feel good. Jay stood in the doorway of the bedroom. His face was red, flushed with a fever, and his hair was stuck to his forehead with sweat. He wore a white short-sleeved pajama shirt with teal sleeves. A brown baseball mitt was in the center of his shirt, catching an oversized baseball. His orange pajama shorts were from a different set. Jay seldom matched his clothes. The white shirt and orange pants were soaked with sweat, clinging to his thin 5-year-old frame. Todd and Emily were packing to leave Raleigh. It was early in the morning, 6 a.m. The sun was already up. Emily put her arm around Jay and gave him some soothing words. She talked to him about going to the couch downstairs and watching a movie. Jay nodded. Todd looked at the television in their room. It showed an exodus, a traffic jam of cars fleeing their city. Dozens of news helicopters cast black shadows on the ground while filming the government checkpoints on every road. Workers in yellow hazmat suits examined people before letting cars pass. Todd walked downstairs. He told Jay to feel better and went into the kitchen to pour his son a dose of cherry-flavored medicine to curb his fever and make him comfortable. Emily tucked Jay into a snuggly bed of blankets and pillows on the couch in front of the living room television. She checked the kids' networks for cartoons, but even those channels showed images of cars stuck in traffic, with the scroll, "Residents Flee Raleigh, North Carolina." Emily switched to their DVR recordings and started a movie. Todd wanted to be one of the cars being filmed on the road. His plan was ruined. Jay was sick. They would not make it through the checkpoints out of Raleigh. The helicopters showed infected people being ushered to government vehicles, separated from their families. Todd would not risk Jay being taken from them. He handed Emily the red syrupy medicine before stepping outside onto their deck. Todd was in a daze. He sat down on the extra-wide steps their contractor built 2 summers before. The steps were stadium-sized and took up an entire corner. They flowed into the yard, allowing anyone to sit on the steps comfortably. The contractor sold them on the idea of a party deck, with the stairs doubling as extra seating for guests. Todd and Emily watched the kids play in the yard from the steps. The kids ate their lunch on them, too. It was a great deck. He heard the door open and close. Emily sat next to him and put her arm around him, the same way she soothed their son a few minutes ago. "What now?" she whispered. "I guess we wait," he told her as she rested her head on his shoulder. "And hope." Matthew Boone, Todd's neighbor, was a road warrior salesman for a technology company. Boone traveled everywhere and all the time. The Boone children were similar in age to Todd's and played together almost every day. 2 weeks ago, the Boones came down with a summer flu. They had fevers, were lethargic, and had no appetite. It was not unusual to have a flu in the summer, but after what happened in Sao Paulo, Brazil, people were on edge. Matthew Boone died 3 days ago. The people in the yellow hazmat suits removed the rest of the Boone bodies yesterday. One mother, and 4 children. The Boones were part of a growing number of dead in Raleigh, more than 1,500 bodies in 3 days. Panic was everywhere. People fled the city. Todd and Emily planned to take their 2 children to New Hampshire, riding out the epidemic at their family cottage. Now that Jay was sick, they needed a new plan. "You don't think we can get through?" Emily asked her husband.
They began to sweat under the strong Carolina sun. It was already 80 degrees at 6:15 in the morning.
"You saw the TV. They have checkpoints on every road. If you're sick, they want you to stay in Raleigh. It's not a recommendation. They're going to keep us here. Or worse, they'll take Jay and send us away."
Todd shut his eyes. "Damn it." They sat on the steps together, trying to make sense out of their situation. He turned and looked at his wife. "How much food do we have?"
"Why?
How much food do we have? The stores are closed. There won't be any more food coming into Raleigh.
We need to make sure we have enough to last a few weeks, maybe a few months. Let's take an inventory. Todd got up. I'm not going to die, and neither are you or the kids. Let's plan on making it through this plague, whatever it is. The first thing we need to do is make sure we have food. 2 hours later, Emily and Todd stood in the kitchen with all of their food categorized on the counters and table. They had short-term perishables and long-term non-perishables. Todd assumed the power would go off if enough people left Raleigh. He suggested they eat everything in the fridge immediately. Meals are going to get smaller and more interesting. We waste nothing. If the kids don't finish something, it gets bagged and they have it at the next meal or for a snack. Same goes for us. Todd paused. I'm going to sneak over to the Boones later and see what they have in the fridge. I'll go behind the houses, not on the street.
Are you crazy? Why are you going to steal their food?
They're dead, Emily. They aren't going to eat it. If this gets any worse, I'm going to steal everyone's food, but I'll start with the Boones before someone else gets the same idea. Todd surveyed the counter and looked at Emily. This is bad. Look at the news reports out of Brazil, and China, and Germany, and Australia. This isn't a passing flu that happened to kill our friends. We're in it, and the best way to survive is to plan to survive. Todd took Emily's trembling hands. She was scared, and he could see despair in her eyes. We have to plan to survive, and our first step is to get as much food as we can. The Boons are gone. I'm taking their food today. We have 2 rain barrels. I'll clean them out, sanitize them with bleach, and we can collect rainwater.
You really think we're okay?
Emily asked hopefully.
I have to. And so do you.
2. The last neighbors in their cul-de-sac, the Williams, pulled out at noon. Todd waited an hour before he walked behind the 2 houses between his home and the Boones. There were woods in each backyard running for 50 to 100 yards, keeping Todd well hidden from the main road. He heard cars honking and frustrated drivers screaming, panicked and impatient people stuck in traffic. It was oppressively hot, as North Carolina is every July. Todd was dripping by the time he arrived at the Boones' sliding glass back door. He cupped his hands and peeked through the glass, spying a dark kitchen and apparently empty house. His sweaty hands and nose left an odd print on the clean glass, like a comma inside a parenthesis. He wondered if the symbol represented something, if teens used it on their phones to signify a sweaty burglar or peeping Tom. Todd tried to slide the door. It was locked.
"So much for easy," he mumbled.
Todd walked off the deck and around the house to a side door leading into the garage. It was also locked. He paused, took a deep breath, and walked as casually as he could to the front door. He turned the handle and went inside. The hazmat people had left the door unlocked after removing the bodies. Todd shut the door quickly. Instinctively, he called out, "Hello?" He waited a second, but there was no response. "Hello?" he yelled again loudly. The house was empty. Todd moved down a hallway to the kitchen and went to work. He had been in the Boone's house for a few parties over the years, but he was not completely familiar with their layout. He was going to have to search for the food stores. Like most houses built in the neighborhood, the Boone's kitchen included a walk-in pantry. Todd stacked the food next to the sliding glass back door. He would use one of his kids' wagons to retrieve the supplies after the sun went down, moving them under the cover of darkness. Todd paused again. "Hello?" he called out. He could not shake the feeling that someone else was in the house. It was just a feeling. He was alone. The Boons were dead. No one was on their street. Everyone was gone. He ignored the eerie feelings and began to search through the kitchen for food not kept in the pantry. He opened the fridge.
"Let's see what we have here."
3. A white van pulled into the cul-de-sac and parked. 4 people in yellow hazmat suits got out of the vehicle.
They split up and worked in pairs, two people approaching each house. One of the people carried a clipboard, the other an automatic weapon. The rifleman stood guard as the clipboard person knocked on the front door. If no one answered, the case in all four of the other houses on the street, the clipboard person walked to the top of the house's driveway touching the street and spray-painted a black symbol before moving to the next residence. Todd watched the van from his upstairs bedroom window. He saw the four people split into pairs and begin their door-to-door search on the other side of the street. He nodded to Emily, and she took Brian, their oldest son, to the attic. Jay was asleep in his bedroom. Todd followed his wife and son. The attic was unfinished and sweltering hot. The temperature increased as Todd trudged up the stairs. He walked to the lone window overlooking the driveway where he could watch the front doors of the two houses next to him. After a few minutes, he saw the yellow puffy suits approaching the front of each home.
"They look like Teletubbies."
"You remember Teletubbies?" Todd asked Emily.
"Not the time," she said,
trying to entertain Brian and keep his mind off the uncomfortable room.
"And why are we up here again?"
The four yellow-suited people met at Todd's house, the fifth on the street. One of them walked up the steps and rang the doorbell. Todd opened the front door. He was red-faced and sweating from his time in the attic. The yellow suit stepped back quickly, shocked to find a person at home and answering the door. The two armed people gripped their rifles in a ready position.
"Sir, are you aware there is a mandatory evacuation of Raleigh? You need to leave."
Todd was unable to determine the sex of the people until now. An elderly woman spoke to him through a clear plastic face shield. She looked hot and uncomfortable. Her face was flushed and her forehead glistened.
"My son is sick," Todd told them solemnly. "He has..."
The woman cut him off, raising her arm into the air and showing her palm.
"We need to see him.
Please, come in. Help us if you can," Todd pleaded. The woman took another step away, backing down the stairs. "Just bring your son to the door and put this in his mouth." She tossed him a white box with a thermometer.
"Is there anyone else home?"
The woman looked at her clipboard. Todd guessed it was a census description. "Your wife and other child?"
"Do you need to see them, too?"
Todd tried to act lethargic and groggy. "We need to see everyone." The woman was not polite. Todd shut the glass storm door and went inside to get his family. He walked slowly and deliberately to the top of the stairs, knowing the woman and the three other people were watching him. He turned left and opened the attic door.
"Emily, you need to come down and stand in the doorway."
"I'm dripping from head to toe. It's a sauna up here."
She came down the attic stairs with their 7-year-old. Mother and child were sweating and red-faced.
"I'll get Jay."
Todd went into Jay's room and lifted his son. Jay was suffering through an actual bout of the flu, one Todd hoped was a benign version rather than the one that killed the Boones. Jay continued to sleep. He was flushed and soaking from night sweats. Todd put the thermometer in his mouth and carried him down the stairs. Sweaty Brian and Emily followed. The hazmat woman stood in the doorway, observing everything through the glass storm door. When she saw Todd and the three seemingly ill people, she backed down the front steps and into the yard. Todd turned the handle and pushed the front door open with Jay's feet.
"Please, what should I do? Our neighbors died a few days ago. Does he have it?"
Todd was a horrible actor, but the situation was so real the four yellow suits did not realize the ruse. The clipboard people spoke to each other as they wrote.
"This area is supposed to be cleared. I'm not a doctor. I don't get paid to deal with this stuff."
The other hazmat person was upset to find the Dixons home.
"Have you had any contact with the Boone family in the last month?" the woman asked Todd.
"Yes, a lot. Jay played with them almost every day."
"Why? Is that bad? Does he have it?"
Todd took a step forward. The men with rifles pointed the guns toward him.
"Why didn't you call the mandatory medical hotline?" the other person asked.
Part of the television scroll below the videos of Raleigh was a phone number to self-report fevers and other flu-like symptoms.
I don't know what you're...
Todd continued his lie. Sir, stay on your porch. You are officially quarantined. I'm going to mark your house as such. Do not leave your residence or attempt to leave Raleigh. Do you understand?
I do. Can't you help us? Can't you help my son?
Todd took a step back towards his house. A medical team will be through soon. The woman pointed to the van, motioning the guards and her associate to go back to it.
Don't you want the thermometer?
Todd asked, begging her for help. Please stay in your house. Your actions may save the rest of us. She started towards the van before stopping and walking back to Todd.
Mr. Dixon, God bless you and your family.
Good luck. Her voice was kind and full of sympathy. Behind her, the other clipboard person was arguing with the rifleman.
I don't have orange paint. I'm not a doctor. They only gave me black paint. What the hell am I supposed to do? They aren't dead or gone.
The woman approached the end of the driveway, and Todd saw her head shake back and forth. The four people got in their van and drove to the next cul-de-sac. Todd stood on the front porch holding Jay until the van left his street. He looked at the four other driveways in his cul-de-sac. Three of the driveways had black V's, probably indicating vacant. The new paint ran down the slopes. The Boone's driveway had two symbols. The first was an orange circle with a line, given to them after a visit from government health officials. Painted over that symbol 2 days ago, when their bodies were removed, was a black circle with a line. Todd went inside. He carried Jay to his bedroom and kissed him on the forehead.
Feel better, buddy.
Car horns continued in the distance as the last residents of Raleigh sat on nearby roads, waiting to join the slow-moving river of fleeing cars on the highway. Todd came downstairs and into the kitchen to speak with Emily and Brian.
Well, he told them, it looks like they bought it.
The Boones, warehouse shoppers and a family of six, tripled Todd and Emily's food inventory. Cases sat on the floor as Emily decided how and where to store the excess. Todd's phone rang. His brother Hank's picture flashed on the screen.
What the hell is happening down there?
Todd heard screaming from the cell before he could bring the phone to his ear.
Hey, Todd said. I don't know. Jay is sick.
Hank was silent.
I know. Todd acknowledged the gravity of the situation. But I think it's just the flu. Not the bad flu, the real flu. Maybe I'm delusional. I gotta believe, right?
Jesus, was all Hank could muster.
Seriously, I think he's going to be fine.
Todd replayed the government interaction from the morning.
I don't know why. I just don't trust the disease people right now. This thing killed my neighbors in a week, and there's still a message to be calm. Calm is not an option.
What are you going to do? Hank was a world away in Dayton, Ohio. There were no confirmed cases in the U.S. outside of Raleigh. The government was praising itself for containing the disease. I'm going to spray paint our driveway with a symbol that says we're dead. We're loading up on food and laying low. This is going to go one of two ways for me. Either Jay is fine, or the four of us will be dead very soon.
Jesus, Hank muttered again.
What do you mean, spray paint your driveway? The girls want to stay home from school, and I'm telling them it's okay.
Hank, do me a favor.
Emily and I are turning off our phones. We're going to play possum for a few weeks. Please relay our status to the family. I'm leaning towards paranoia right now.
Sure. Jesus, anything.
And Hank, Todd said before turning off his phone.
Yeah? Keep your girls home from school.
4. 5 days later, Todd left his home before dawn. The car horns had stopped days ago. He walked through his subdivision in hopes of finding other people, friends who could help him through the crisis. He was back at his house by 7 a.m. Emily stood in the kitchen drinking coffee. Jay and Brian were still asleep. Jay was fully recovered from his fever.
"How many people are still here?"
she asked anxiously. Neither of them had left the cul-de-sac since the yellow hazmat encounter.
"You don't want to know. I went through ours and three other subdivisions."
He went to the coffee.
"I'll walk around myself," she threatened.
Todd poured a cup. He turned around and faced his wife. He dropped his eyes and stared at the floor as he responded, "Every house is vacant or dead." He raised his eyes from the floor and looked at his wife.
"We're alone."
Emily put her hand over her mouth in shock.
"Do you know who is dead as opposed to gone?"
"Most of the people are gone. 2/3 of the houses have a V in the driveway. About 25 have a black circle. The Mitchells are dead. So are the Vogels and the Taylors."
Todd's voice was flat, emotionless as he relayed the deaths of their friends.
Emily bent over. She was almost sick.
"All those kids. Oh, my God."
She started crying and stood upright for a hug and comfort from Todd.
"This has to be a nightmare. Tell me this is a nightmare."
"We're going to be okay. Let's stick to our plan. Stay in the house. Maybe the backyard or the pool next door. We don't go in the front yard or cul-de-sac until we know it's safe. I'll retrieve as much food as I can."
He held her tightly.
"We're going to be okay. The rest of the world is screwed, but we're going to be okay."
Emily sobbed uncontrollably in her husband's arms. 5. Todd rode his bike a few miles from his house. Sweat dripped off his forehead from the stifling heat and humidity. He used a paved bike path system called the Greenway that ran through woods and public parks throughout Raleigh. The Greenway kept him off the main streets. When Todd was far enough away from his house, he pulled off the path and into a subdivision. He did not find a charged cell phone until the third house. He only went into homes with what he now called the Black Circle of Death. The power was still working in Raleigh. The front door opened into an air-conditioned home. Todd welcomed the cool air as he searched. He dialed his brother, John Dixon, in Charleston, South Carolina.
"John, it's Todd."
"What the hell is going on up there? Are you okay? Is your family okay?"
John had not heard from his brother since the start of the epidemic. All he had was second-hand news from Hank.
"We're all fine. I'm going to explain everything. Let me conference Hank and Paul into the call."
John heard the phone click and go dead. 1 minute later, the four brothers were on the line together.
"We all on?"
Todd asked the group. He received 3 yeses.
"Seriously, what the hell is happening? Raleigh is a dead spot on the map. There's no communication. Whose cell phone is this?"
John was desperate to know what was happening. The flu had taken its first victim in Charleston yesterday. Hank and Paul were equally excited and curious to hear the happenings in the dead city, as it was referred to on the news.
"About 2 weeks ago, my neighbor died, followed days later by his wife and 4 children. Jay and Brian played with those kids every day since we moved here."
He went on to talk about the hazmat-suited people, Jay's flu, and the markings on the driveway.
"No one has been back since. I haven't seen any trucks or people for about a week. I think everyone is either dead or gone.
It's crazy.
We really are a dead city."
Todd waited for questions. When none were asked, he continued.
"So far we're fine. Jay's flu came and went. It helped us fool the government people. We heard army trucks rolling up and down the main streets all the time, but since the pandemic has moved to other cities, the military bugged out. If there are people alive in Raleigh other than us, I haven't seen them."
"What are you going to do?"
Now that the basics were answered, Paul was curious about the future. He and his wife Rachel were in Cincinnati, Ohio.
"We're holding tight for now. The power is still on. I plan on stealing a generator if it goes off." Of course, then I have to figure out how to work the damn thing. I've been collecting food from other houses. Food and water and rain barrels.
We had our first case yesterday. First death, I should say. It's here, in Charleston. You've all seen it. It's everywhere along the East Coast.
There was panic in John's voice.
Greg is up at Hightower for baseball camp. I don't know what we're going to do. The travel restrictions and checkpoints mean I can't get to him and he can't get back here.
Greg was John's 14-year-old son, stuck at his prep school in Massachusetts. Todd did not have an answer. I don't know if I'm out of the woods yet. A lot of people left Raleigh healthy. They might still be healthy like me. Maybe my time hasn't come yet.
Rachel hasn't been eating. She's been picking her food for months.
Paul was talking about his wife. His voice was soft.
My girls are losing weight too, but Paul, they're women. None of them ever eat. Don't panic yet. There's hope for a cure or a vaccine. Just hold tight.
Hank was upbeat.
I don't want to stay on the phone too long.
The government may be monitoring, and I don't want them coming back to my house and finding healthy people. I'm not calling from my house, but if they trace who I called, it won't be hard for them to figure out I'm Todd Dixon and not the dead owner of this phone. We should plan on speaking again, developing a plan. Assume you will survive and figure out what our next steps are. I won't have access to a phone for another few days. I'll try you again when I do.
The whole world dies, and you think the four of us will make it?
Paul asked him.
Yes,
Todd lied. And let's make some plans for when that happens. Todd left the cell phone on the counter and checked the house for any food or supplies he could fit in his backpack. Scavenging was a habit now, but it was not necessary. Todd and Emily had more food than they could eat in 10 years. He put 3 unopened boxes of cereal and 2 bottles of water in his pack, opening a third water to drink before walking to his bike. He clicked the button on his walkie-talkie.
All good. Heading home.
You didn't say over.
His son Jay crackled from the other device.
Be back in 30.
Love you. Over.
Beads of sweat returned to Todd's forehead as he rode home. 6. The Dixon brothers spoke weekly, updating each other on the status of their towns. Media outlets were useless, spewing propaganda and false information about a cure and hope against the unrelenting death. They were 2 months into the pandemic. John, Todd, Hank, and Paul remained healthy.
Rachel died today, Paul said solemnly. Why I'm not dead, I don't know. We did everything together. It's been in Cincinnati for weeks. I should be sick.
I'm so sorry, Paul.
I wish we could be there for you,
Todd offered.
I buried her behind our house, under the lilac trees she loved.
The last word was lost as Paul sobbed.
My girls were sick, too.
They're all gone now.
Hank's voice was empty. His family died 2 phone calls ago, but the memory was fresh and painful enough that he continued to tell his brothers. Paul answered loudly through his tears.
Hank, we need to turn ourselves in. We can help. There is still time here in Ohio. They can use our blood to test for a cure. We're the answer. It's what Rachel wanted me to do, to save people.
No, John said firmly. You're a fool if you do it. If you believe those yellow-suited assholes are going to take a pint of your blood and thank you for your service, you're insane. If you don't end up locked in a room after everyone else is dead, you'll be carved up with your liver in a bowl inside of a week.
You selfish jackass, Paul yelled. I'm talking about saving the rest of humanity, and you're scared they might detain me for longer than I want? You've seen the news. No one has a clue what to do. Maybe we have antibodies in our blood. I've contacted people at the university here, doctors I can trust. We can help.
Everyone calm down.
Todd found himself breaking up the same arguments during every call. Paul,
We voted. You need to stay hidden. Hank, you have to get it together and keep yourself alive. Focus.
There was a pause before John spoke. My kids are still fine. I don't think we're going to get sick. We need a place to meet. All of us.
John did not talk about his wife, Sharon. It was understood non-Dixons would succumb to the disease, nicknamed the Rapture.
You could be saving her, Paul interjected. You son of a bitch. You think if I believed that for a second I wouldn't turn myself in? If I thought the idiots left in the world could figure out how to save my wife with my blood?
Todd cut him off. I want to meet in Hanover. I know it's cold, like all the time, but it's remote. I don't believe any bad people or things will find us up there. If we pick a good house, like the house we grew up in, well, it was built a long time ago, before modern conveniences. It has fireplaces, wood stoves, a wood room connected to the house. It's almost colonial. It's right next to a pond for water and fishing. We could keep the land around the pond cleared for crops.
He paused to let the idea sink in. Hanover was in New Hampshire. It was their hometown.
Greg is still at Hightower. He's not sick. He can get to Hanover on his own. I don't know when I can get there. My family would have to avoid D.C. and New York and Philly and Boston. It might take a long time without cars.
John's brain worked through the idea, but he was sold. Todd could tell from the response.
Hank, Paul, think about it. I'm going to ride out the winter here in North Carolina. When it starts to get warm, I'm going to make a move. That's about 6 or 8 months from now. Frankly, everything should be over by then. Either we have a cure and we're rebuilding our world, or we don't have a cure and avoiding people won't be much of a problem. Either way, setting up camp in New Hampshire isn't a bad idea.
Paul continued to weep. Hank responded, Things are still crazy here. We're probably in the middle of the cycle, so I don't know if I can leave by spring or if I'll even be alive. The government has stepped up the raids and collections. If I make it through, I'll get to New Hampshire by May or June. There was life back in Hank's voice. I'll be there.
Hank, what do you mean by collections?
John suspected the government was kidnapping healthy citizens, but he had not witnessed it.
Just keep to yourselves and don't trust anyone. Paul, believe us when we tell you to stay home. Don't turn yourself in.
Hank's tone was firm.
Don't trust anyone.
Paul, take care of yourself. Think about our plan.
Todd brought the conversation back on track.
Paul cleared his throat.
Hank, I'll come up in the spring and we'll make the trip together. It's too dangerous for me to try and get up there now. I'll be there in the spring. Please, don't leave without me.
Hank lived 1 hour north of Paul.
I wouldn't dream of it, brother. I'll see the rest of you in Hanover.
Hank issued another warning. I'm going to say it again because it's important. Don't trust anyone.
They said their goodbyes and condolences to Paul before the brothers hung up for the last time.
John held the phone in his palm.
Matt, Craig, come in here for a minute.
He called his sons into the room. They were around a corner listening to the conversation.
Aunt Rachel died, John told them quietly. We're meeting your uncles in Hanover next year. I need to call Greg and tell him what to do.
John put his hand on his youngest son's shoulder as he dialed Greg's phone number in Massachusetts.
7. John hung up the phone, closed his eyes, and bowed his head. His sons, Matt and Craig, stood in the living room with him, listening to every word their father said to their brother. John's request for Greg to stay alive hung in the air.
What do we do now, Dad? Matt asked. Do we start to make our way up to Hanover? We might make it before the first snow.
Matt, 17, was a few years older than Greg. He was doing well at a local private school and had hopes of going north for college next fall.
But Mom is upstairs, and she's still alive. We can't leave her!
10-year-old Craig yelled at his older brother. The young boy was crying. John opened his eyes and looked at his sons. He was the father, but there was nothing that prepared him to lead a family through this type of situation. The world was in chaos. His partner was days from dying, and one of his sons was 700 miles away. John's head was swimming. Your mother isn't dead. We would be killing her if we leave and a cure is found. We don't leave, we stay with her. Do you understand?
John looked at Craig as he said the last sentence, reaching out and wiping the tears from the boy's face.
His sons nodded. Craig cracked a small smile. When your mother gets better, and we think we can make it up to Hanover, we leave, and we decide if Craig stops at Uncle Todd's. He can ride out the first winter in Raleigh. Todd and Emily will need a lot of help with your cousins.
I don't want to split up, Craig said quickly.
I know. That's why I said we'll decide later.
Hey, maybe the government will come through with a cure and this whole thing will be over.
John gave them a weak smile, a knowing smile that told his boys none of that was going to happen.
Has Mom had anything to eat? Matt asked.
No.
But she's a fighter.
John was the only one who had been in Sharon's room in the last 2 days. Once the end symptoms of the rapture began, she asked her sons not to see her again. She gave a teary goodbye 3 days ago. It was not a bad thing for her kids to see her. During the final phase of the rapture, a person was delirious with joy. A rapture victim was more creepy than scary. The high fever, or bacteria, or virus, whatever it was, boiled the brain to the point where people felt happy, peaceful, and full of joy. The name was coined by the rapturous-like emotions exhibited at the end of the disease. John was devastated. He knew there was no cure coming, and his wife would be dead in 24 to 48 hours. He continued to lie to Craig, though he assumed even the boy knew the truth. While the last 3 days for a rapture victim were peaceful, the world's last few months were chaotic and violent. Countries were filled with looting and rioting. Governments were unfriendly to survivors, seeking healthy people who did not exhibit symptoms. Distrust and paranoia reigned. The crazy time was winding down. It had been 2 months since Raleigh went dark. Everyone in North America was sick or dead. There was still mild panic, but it was over. Humanity was finished. The world slowly accepted its fate. Even as the population dwindled and the military's power disappeared, John believed there were roadblocks on every route headed north. Information was sparse. All he had to work off of were looped television images of yellow-suited people with guns and thermometers checking cars and separating families. John would not make a move north until he was positive everyone was dead. And by the time he could be sure, winter would block the way to his son. For now, at least for another day or two, John would care for Sharon. How his wife had lasted this long, he did not know. Every other person from their circle of friends had been dead for weeks.
8. Greg's eyes opened with the sun. He looked at his watch out of habit. It read 7:37 a.m. He'd been asleep for 2 hours, taking the first nap of a schedule he devised and implemented 1 week ago. Greg was reversing his sleeping habits, sleeping in the day and staying awake at night. His plan was to leave his school and travel under the cover of darkness. His first thought was always, "I'm late for breakfast." His stomach ached with hunger pains. Reality quickly set in. As much as Greg wanted to forget his current situation, the fact that it was freezing in his dorm room and he was a smart and grounded 14-year-old
made it impossible. He was alone at his prep school, High Tower Academy, outside of Boston, Massachusetts. His friends, teachers, and everyone else at the school were dead, rotting in a building just yards away. 3 months earlier, the pandemic struck New York City, Boston, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and all the cities up and down the coast. Panic ensued, and roads shut. Greg was 700 miles from his home in South Carolina, attending baseball training camp in Massachusetts. With at least 10 major cities closed between him and his family, Greg was stuck. The last phone call he had with his father was over a month ago. It came with news that his mother was sick, which meant she was now dead. Greg replayed that conversation in his head every morning. His father was strong in the face of the disease. "Look, I don't know if you're going to get sick. I don't know if I'm going to make it either, but right now we aren't sick, and that's weird. Your uncles are healthy, too. We have a plan. It starts with us heading north, away from people. We're going to Hanover, up to the lake house, to figure out a life. Do you think you can get there?" "I guess. I mean, I know how to read a map. It's kind of far. I can't drive." Greg was terrified. "Don't try to drive. The highways are shut. You'll get picked up, locked up, studied. You have to go at night, in the woods, or on back roads. When you see the military, you have to hide." "You really think everyone is going to die?"
"Greg, you're about to grow very fast."
"Yes, everyone is either dead or in bed with the rapture. The phones are going to stop working, maybe even today. The power is going to stop working, maybe today. Here is what you need to do. Stay low at school for another few weeks, hiding like we talked about. Wait until you don't see anyone for 3 or 4 days. As soon as you're clear, head to Hanover. Get up there, find a house, maybe the one where I grew up. Find food, make fires to keep warm, boil water. I'll come for you when I can. Use the lake house if you want, but get up there. If I live, I'll get there. Your uncles will get there. Remember, people are scared. They're desperate. Don't trust anyone you aren't related to. The police, the government, they're trying to find a cure. If you aren't sick, they'll take you and do whatever they can to try and save others. Don't get caught."
"Dad, I'm scared."
"I know. I'm scared, too. I'm sad. I'm scared, but I know you can do this. I love you. Know that I love you." There was a pause. "Greg, tell me you understand what you need to do. Stay at Hightower, hiding, and then get to Hanover when you know everyone is dead."
"I can do it. I love you too, Dad. Tell Mom I love her. Tell Matt and Craig I love them. I'll see you soon. Whenever you get there, I'll be in Hanover waiting."
Greg was crying.
"Greg, I love you. Your mother loves you. Your brothers need you to stay alive. I don't know how long it will be, but we'll see you again. Don't lose faith. Stay alive. Just stay alive. I love you."
Cell phone signals ceased a day later. Greg did not tell his dad about his food situation, or how the radiators were out and the cold was keeping him awake. He could not talk about the smell, which grew stronger and more rancid every day. Greg kept all of the windows and doors shut in his dorm to escape the odor. Greg was cold, and he was almost out of food. Late October in New England is beautiful, but it can be unpredictable. Greg looked at the thermometer suction cup to his window, 42 degrees inside his dorm room.
"I have to leave today. It will be freezing overnight in the next few weeks."
He talked to himself. It helped him deal with the new world's silence, and almost made him feel as if there were other people around. He was not having conversations with himself. He was not losing his mind.
At least he hoped he was not losing his mind. He looked at the other bed in his room. His roommate Darren died months ago when the rapture spread through his dorm and the rest of the school. School had not started. Greg and Darren were attending a baseball camp. Half of Hightower Academy's students were back on campus attending academic or athletic clinics. Darren left to go to the quarantine dorms the first week. Of the 6 dorms at the school, 4 were converted into hospitals, servicing the students, faculty, and residents of the town. 2 of the dorms were converted into morgues soon after. Travel restrictions meant parents could not claim bodies. Most of the parents were sick or dead. Even without the travel issues, the kids and their bodies were orphans. Darren and Greg were best friends since the first day of freshman year. They played baseball together in the fall and spring. When roommate sign-ups came out the previous year, they knew immediately they would room together, share baseball stories from the summer, help each other out on homework. It was a friendship that lasted a lifetime. Darren's lifetime. Greg kept Darren's bed made and left his side of the room alone after they took Darren away in August. Darren did not like his property touched. Not that anyone did, but he was particularly protective. Greg kept to his side of the room for the first month, even after he knew Darren and all the other kids were dead. Greg did not so much as sit on Darren's bed or touch his books, desk, or clothes. Soon after the last phone call with his father, Greg went through Darren's things. He looked for anything he could find that would help him survive. Better clothes, knives, maps, anything. Greg searched the entire dorm. He knew he had to travel light to Hanover. He treated his mission like a scavenger hunt. One day he looked for the best pair of pants. He would find a pair and put them in his shoulder bag until he scavenged better pants with more pockets or warmer fabric. The scavenger hunt list included essential items he needed for the long trek north. Greg began sleeping under his bed after they took Darren away. He set up soft blankets on the floor and went under at night. Anyone looking for students or scavenging for food and supplies would not see him through the small door window. Greg found a master key on one of the dead counselors in the morgue dorm. He randomly locked rooms in the dorm so it would seem natural that his room was locked. He also messed up his room, giving it the appearance of having been picked over. He found food in the cafeteria and moved it to his room so he would not have to leave the dorm. He stopped using light at night. Greg was used to being monitored. He was 14 and at prep school. It was hard for him to understand that no one was looking for him. Even after the phone call with his father, when it was explained that everyone was dead or dying, Greg was certain there were other people around. He treated finding food, staying out of sight, beefing up his supplies, like it was a game. How quickly could he get in and out of a building? How slowly and stealthily could he move through campus? Greg was too young to realize Hightower Academy's campus shut down weeks earlier. Doctors worked in the dorms. People in yellow hazmat suits moved bodies from the quarantine to the morgue. But all activity stopped long ago. The power was off. The phones did not work. No one came to campus. Greg managed to slip through the cracks. He was the only person alive at Hightower, and had been for close to a month. Greg stayed in his room and hid, but no one was looking for him. The world was dead. After the doctors and yellow plastic people left campus, Greg continued to hear airplanes, helicopters, and loud diesel military vehicles. When Greg spoke to his father on the phone, the helicopters and jets were a constant in the air, moving from Air Force bases in New Hampshire and Boston. Each week, the number of aircraft lessened until there was one plane a day, or every other day. One week ago, Greg saw a jet heading out to the Atlantic, straight east. Since that last plane, all man-made noise ceased.
Greg was in New England in late fall, needing to travel 100+ miles by foot or bike to Hanover, New Hampshire. He studied maps and knew the two highways he needed to take. Despite his father's warnings, Greg planned on using major highways to Hanover. Today, he decided to leave campus and walk to his English teacher's house in the town near the highway. He packed his bag during the morning hours, thought about his route, and went to sleep at 10 a.m. Greg awoke in the dark. He got dressed, brushed his teeth, and grabbed his gear. He was used to working in the pitch black after 4 weeks with no power. The moon was half full and provided enough light when he left the dorm. The smell hit Greg as soon as he opened the door. He put the crook of his arm over his mouth and nose and hoped the odor would subside as he moved away from campus and the morgue dorms. It was cold, crisp and dry outside. Leaves covered the ground. No one was around to rake them and keep the campus in its typical immaculate condition. The dry refuse crunched under Greg's feet as he walked out of the school's gates. Hightower Academy was a mile from Greg's destination house. He wanted a test run on this first night, staying close to campus. If he ran into people, Greg could return to the safety and security of his dorm room. Campus was deserted, and he believed he could tough it out for another 8 months, if he could find food and stop the horrific smell. Greg picked his English teacher's house because he saw her in the morgue dorm when he lifted the master key off his dorm counselor. Ms. Berry was a single woman just 3 years out of college. She lived alone. Her house should be empty. It might be ransacked, but there would not be any bodies in the house. Greg was brave, and growing braver every day of his independence. But he was still 14, and decided he would rather not sleep in a house with a dead body. Greg remembered being dropped off 3 months ago by his mother. They turned off the highway and drove 3 blocks when Greg pointed to the small yellow house. "That's where Ms. Berry lives. She had our English class over for a cookout last year." The car ride was the last time Greg saw his mother. She insisted on driving him to school, spending the time with him. He wanted to fly, despite his secret fear of flying, land at Logan Airport in Boston and take the shuttle to Hightower. His mom would not let him. It was like she knew their time was fleeting. She forced him to take the long car ride with her. He missed his mother. He missed his family. But he could not let his grief stop him from moving forward. Greg made the 2 turns onto the town's main street and began the long walk toward Ms. Berry's. Every house was dark. It was 8:30 p.m. The smell of fire and smoke should have flowed out of chimneys all over town. Other than an occasional bird or squirrel and the crunch of Greg's feet in the leaves, there was no sound or indication of life. Clouds drifted in front of the moon, blocking Greg's source of light, and he stopped to listen for noises. He did not hear any. He walked for 10 minutes, and as far as he could tell, he was the only animal on 2 feet out this evening. Greg moved painfully slow, and he was soon frustrated with having to watch his step in the dark. He came to the crest of a small hill. Normally, while he could not see the city of Boston, there was an orange glow over the horizon. Tonight, on this late October evening, there was no light. A town of several million was dark. Greg expected fire, carnage, something to show such a large concentration of people once existed, hopefully still existed. Nothing. No sound from the highway. No light from the city. He might as well have been walking through a secluded rainforest or national park. Greg decided not to talk to himself while on his trek, but he could not stifle the wow as he let the realization sink in that he was probably alone in New England. How many people had the disease killed? Were the survivors friendly? Were there even any survivors? For the last month he followed his father's advice, hid from people, moved around at night. He was more or less playing a game rather than living in fear. Now,
He did not know how to feel. Greg looked around. He had a creepy feeling that he was being watched. He did not hear or see anyone. He shook off his fear and continued towards his destination. After 20 minutes, he stood in front of Miss Barry's. The house was dark and quiet. He tried the front door. It was locked. He walked around the house to find a back door he remembered from the cookout. That door was also locked.
"Darn it,"
Greg muttered. He noticed a window was open a crack. He reached over and pushed it up. The window was at chest level, and Greg struggled to pull himself up from the ground. He looked around in the moonlight and noticed a lawn chair. He pulled it under the window, and a moment later, he was inside Miss Barry's house. It was cold and dark inside. Greg timed his journey with the rising half-moon. He had 2 weeks of half to full, and then back to half-moon again. It provided light for his hike. Inside the house, his only source of light was gone. Greg stood in the kitchen just inside the window, as if he were a burglar, keeping quiet and still. He considered using a flashlight, but he did not want to draw attention to the house. The home was empty. It was a perfect place for him to spend his first night, but Greg was wide awake. The short trip had taken more time than he expected, but there was plenty of night left for him to walk. He considered his options. He could go back to campus and settle into the Founder's Library at Hightower. It was a small brick building with comfortable furniture and a giant fireplace. He could live there through the winter. He thought the cold might mask the smell of the rotting corpses. Hightower was the safe and easy choice, except there was no food. Greg scoured the dining hall kitchen for non-perishable food, but it was all gone, eaten by healthcare workers and government officials during their occupation of the school. He scavenged a few cans of Franks and beans, and one large can of green beans, but his food options were reduced to sifting through dorm rooms for candy bars and snack foods. Yesterday, he ate his last bowl of beans. Greg had not spoken to anyone for a month, and he desperately wanted to see another person. Hightower was deserted. If making the trip to Hanover gave him the opportunity to find his father and brothers or one of his uncles, and he could talk to someone, that reward alone was worth the journey. Greg needed companionship. He made the decision to move forward towards New Hampshire. The practice run to Ms. Barry's was over. Greg's eyes adjusted to the darkness as he felt around the kitchen cabinets. He opened several in hopes of finding food. He was rewarded with a pantry of soup. He pulled the top off a can and used 2 fingers like a spoon to taste the contents. He could not read the label in the dark, but was so ravenous he did not care what flavor he scooped. He brought the can closer and continued to finger the thick, cold split pea soup into his mouth. Despite the temperature and unappealing consistency, Greg devoured the can quickly. He washed his fingers in the kitchen sink before cupping water into his mouth to drink. Greg placed the 2 additional cans of soup from the cabinet into his backpack. His former teacher was a single woman who hated to cook. The only other food he could find was a box of Raisin Bran. Greg pulled the plastic bag from the box and placed the cereal in his pack before zipping the top compartment and slinging it. He unlocked the door to the backyard, walked outside, and made his way to Highway 93 North. His stride was longer and his pace quicker as he began the journey to meet his family in Hanover, New Hampshire. "Rock and roll," he said aloud. His white teeth reflected the moonlight as he grinned. 9. When the Dixon brothers hung up the phone on what would be their last call, Paul was in mourning. His house was in a small subdivision set back from the road and away from busy streets. His location provided the advantage of being in a populous area, Cincinnati, while remote enough that it would be overlooked. He was, in essence, hiding in plain sight, and faced no danger of being found or captured.
Cincinnati, Ohio's population was just over 1 million people. Like many Midwestern cities, it did not have a natural border, such as a large lake or ocean. It sprawled in all directions. Some might argue the Ohio